Salt. Today we're going to talk about salt. And I have a little salt quiz for you. And the quiz is, I want you to see if, you know, keep your own score. Try to name the top five uses of salt in the USA. Okay, are you ready? Number one, 70% of all salt is used for winter roadway safety. I mean, just think about it. I mean, they just pour salt on all those roads. Of course, down in Texas, we don't see that a whole lot. Anyway, number two, 12% of all the salt is used for, do you know what it is? Water conditioning, the water softener routine. Very good. Number three. No guesses? Chemical feedstock. That means, you know, like chlorine and all the different kinds of chemicals and stuff like that. 7% of all salt is used for that. And then number four. Keep going. Agricultural uses, actually. Use salt and different kinds of feed and that kind of stuff. And finally, number five. Very good. We got table salt kind of stuff. That's right. According to Mark Kurlansky, the author of the book, and I couldn't believe there actually was a book like this, Salt, A World History. Salt, he says, I had to go look at it. I had to go to Barnes & Noble and find that book. I thought, I can't believe there's a book about it. Anyway, salt, the only rock we eat, has made a glittering and often surprising contribution to the history of mankind. I didn't know. In fact, I borrowed one of his chapter titles for the title of my message today, The Odium of Sodium. I just like saying it. The Odium of Sodium. Kind of cool. I don't know. Anyway. Kurlansky writes in his book that salt is so common, so easy to obtain, and so inexpensive that we have forgotten that from the beginning of civilization until about 100 years ago, salt was one of the most sought-after commodities in human history. At times, he writes, Roman soldiers were even paid in salt. Would that work? Work for you? I'm not sure that would work for me. Which is the origin of the word salary. So the next time you get a salary, think that originates from salt and be glad they didn't give you a box of salt. It's also where we get the expression worth his salt. I mean, you've heard that before, worth his salt. What does that mean? Well, salt used to be what they paid people, so on. Jesus was a master at using some of the most common elements in life in various object lessons to help people understand spiritual truth. He took a mustard seed and he taught people about how the kingdom of God starts small and then expands. He used thirst and fresh water to reach a Samaritan woman with the gospel. He used bread and wine as a symbol of his body and blood to teach his disciples that he would always be with them and he would always sustain them. And in the Sermon on the Mount, he uses two more very common, the most common things imaginable, to teach a lesson. Salt and light. Salt was a common substance in the Mediterranean world. Even the first century. Every household, just like today, would use salt in various ways, no matter how poor that they might be. It was used as it is today to season food. And in the centuries before refrigeration had been invented, salt was the primary means of preserving meat. So it was a very important commodity. So let's turn to the Sermon on the Mount. The second in the series from Matthew 5, that I've titled The Kingdom of Heaven, because everything Jesus is talking about here relates to life in the kingdom. Let's see what he has to say and how he uses this salt. Matthew chapter 5, beginning with verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Note, Jesus does not say, you should be the salt of the earth. He does not say, I hope that you will eventually become the salt of the earth. He doesn't say, I hope you will try to be salt of the earth. He states it like it's a fact. You are the salt of the earth. And remember now, he's talking to his disciples. And when we see the word disciple, we think... Nobody was here last week. When we think disciple, we see disciple, we think... Apprentice. Very good. We had one person here last week. That was good. All right. So it's an apprentice thing. So he's talking to those people who are following him, learning from him. And then he adds something. He adds something that I find rather disturbing about what happens to the salt if it were to lose its saltiness. It worries me what he says. The thought of failing to be salt and being thrown out and trampled underfoot, that bothers me. Does that bother you? I mean, I worried about that all week. And Luke, he comes and he has also the Sermon on the Mount in kind of a different form, sort of some different memories of that, I suppose. And he records it a little bit different, this saying of Jesus. He says in Luke 14, salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. Now, is Jesus really saying what I think he's saying there? Isn't manure just a nice word for, He's pretty serious. The Greek verb morino, translated lose its saltiness, can mean to become tasteless or insipid. And it's used of salt very often. But it can also mean the same word morino. It can also mean to become or to show oneself to be foolish. This word is used in this way by the Apostle Paul in Romans 1:22 when he's describing people who exchange their knowledge of the true God for idols of wood and stone. And he says, although they claim to be wise, they become fools. Morino. What's more foolish and insipid than so-called Christians who don't live in a way that makes a difference for their Lord? That verb translated trampled underfoot, it means to tread so heavily as to injure. But the same word, katapateo is the word, which is kind of fun to say. Katapateo, it also means to look on with scorn. So perhaps Jesus is using this word, katapateo, as more than a metaphor of people who should be salt and aren't being salt, and the salt that's no good is trampled underfoot. Maybe he's also meaning people will look upon you with scorn. If we no longer bear the name of Christ well and act as salt and light in the world, then we become the objects of scorn, a joke in the eyes of the people, the very people we are to influence for Christ, the odium of sodium. How is it possible to lose our saltiness? Sodium chloride, which is the technical chemical, the name for salt, can become contaminated by being mixed with impurities. And then it becomes useless, and the salt is no longer effective. If we become so assimilated into a secular culture that we begin compromising our values, we begin to lose influence. How does a believer become so assimilated into the world, so contaminated by the impurities of the world, that his godly influence is compromised. Well, as I thought about that, I thought, I don't think that happens overnight. I think there are basically two almost imperceptible steps that take us eventually to a place where we're far from the Lord and we're no longer acting as salt and light, and we become fairly worthless. And those steps include, first, loving the things of this world. 1 John 2, the apostle writes, "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in it." The first step in losing one's saltiness is not some overt outward act against God. It's just often an inward desire for different things in the world that begins to grow stronger in us to the point where we love them more than we love God. And that is the first commandment, remember? Love the Lord your God with all your heart. The first step in the compromise of our faith is that subtle temptation to lower our eyes from the throne of grace and our affections from God and begin to focus on lesser things of life. Things that aren't necessarily evil in themselves, but they simply take the place of God as first in our heart. Jesus chastised the church of Ephesus in Revelation 2:4. He said, "You have forsaken your first love." When there's anything in our hearts that we love more than Christ, we begin losing our saltiness. Loving the things of the world leads to the next step, which is conforming to the world. Paul writes in Romans 12:2, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will." Putting the Lord second to the more pressing desire of the moment can easily move from the realm of rare exception to regular habit, the pattern of the world. When we find ourselves conforming to the pattern of this world, we begin losing our saltiness, our impact, our effectiveness, our influence. The call of Jesus Christ, it means either that we are the salt of the earth, or else we're good for nothing. Either we're faithful to the call, or crushed beneath it. That's a sobering thing, not to be taken lightly. But along with these disturbing words of Jesus, at least disturbing to me, there is also something sublime in these words of Jesus. When Jesus says, "You are the salt and light," that means He thinks your life counts for something. Your life, what you do with it, really matters. In a culture that worships celebrity, where people will do or say just about anything to get their 15 seconds of fame on YouTube, where only the rich and famous seem to count and be able to make a difference, God says, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." It's not those people spending millions of dollars to get your vote. It's you. It's not Bill Gates or those other super rich people. It's you. It's not the super gifted athletes or rock stars or movie stars followed around by an army of photographers hoping to catch them doing something good, or even better for them, something bad. It's you. You are the salt of the earth. You are the one who will stand for right in your workplace. You are the one who will speak words of kindness to the kid who's ridiculed at school. You are the one that your neighbor or your coworker or your schoolmate will watch and might just in you catch a glimpse of the living Christ. This isn't, in the end, an intimidating imperative for Christ. It's a powerful statement of affirmation that your life counts. Jesus isn't wagging His finger in your face saying, "You'd better act like salt and light if you know what's good for you." Not at all. I don't think so. The warning's there, yes. But I think Jesus is addressing one of the biggest fears in your life, the fear that your life just won't really count for much in the end. There is indeed an imperative in the passage, but I don't think it was delivered in the tone of "let your light shine" or else. I think it was more with the tone of, because your life matters, because you are mine, my apprentice, because you are salt and you are light, then shine for all your worth. And how do we do that? How do we be salty? What kind of does that mean? I think a couple of things. It's unseen influence. Salt cannot easily be seen when it's added to food, but its preservative power is tasted and its good effect experienced. Jesus lists these eight qualities that we looked at last week in the Beatitudes. They are not flashy or attention-grabbing characteristics. We impact this world by being poor in spirit, not arrogant and proud. By mourning with those who mourn, not by pronouncing condemnation. It's in being merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, standing for righteousness in spite of criticism, rejection, and even persecution, that we influence the world for Christ. How do you know the popcorn's salted? You can't really see it, but one bite and you know. In the same way, your life may not be this high-profile, high-visibility kind of thing, but the people who know you, the people who work with you, the people who go to school with you, they know if you're salt. It's an unseen influence. Second, Jesus is very direct about this when he says, do good work. He says, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. And we must be found doing the same kinds of good deeds that Jesus did. He touched people's lives around him. So can you. So can I. I may not be able to heal my neighbor of disease, but I can bring a measure of comfort by caring. Our senior high students are getting ready for this mission trip. It's an intense week of serving God, doing good work in His name. This summer they're going to Juarez, Mexico to help build a home for a poor family and to minister to children in the name of Christ. Our middle school students are planning a trip out to Louisiana to a work camp where they'll worship with other kids and participate with other kids and do some Bible study with other kids and that kind of stuff. But in the end, the heart of this camp that they're going to is about serving people. We have a group of adults headed to Monterrey, Mexico, where we will be working with a small church in Monterrey. We're going to basically do two things. Help them put a new roof on their little church and work with neighborhood children. We do good works, not to impress God or to win His favor, or to win favor with people. We do good works because we're His children. And we act like Him. We do the things that He's doing. We're His hands, His feet, His mouth. He works in this world primarily through His people, that others may be blessed and may come to know Him as well. Salt. What did Jesus really have in mind? Was it the flavor factor, you know, the table salt kind of idea? Maybe. But I doubt that was the main thing. After all, and He didn't say, you are the sugar of the world and you are to make everything sweet. He doesn't say that. Was it the preservative property of salt. That's what most of the commentators think. That's what most of the Bible scholars think. But I suspect it might have been something else. Another quality in salt that I suspect Jesus had foremost in mind. There is an obscure story in the Old Testament about the prophet Elisha. Elisha was the guy who received the prophetic mantle from the great prophet Elijah. He followed in his footsteps. And in the moment that Elisha became this lead prophet, he's hanging out in Jericho. And the people of Jericho come to him, and they know he's this great prophet. And they're complaining to him, and they're telling him that the water and the land around their city is just really bad. It's not worth much. And he tells them to do something very strange. 2 Kings chapter 2, he says, "Bring me a new bowl and put salt in it." So they bring him this bowl. And then he goes out, he puts salt into it. And then he goes out to the water and he throws the salt into the spring. And he says, "This is what the Lord says, I've healed this water. Never again will it cause death or make the land unproductive. And the water has remained wholesome to this day, according to the word Elisha had spoken." That's a weird kind of story, isn't it? Here's the thing about that story. From ancient time, salt was not only a symbol, but a means of purification. It still is. Remember the third most common use of salt. All right, we have our... Yeah, here we go. Everybody's got this, right? If you live in Pflugerville. Because the water's horrible. I remember when we moved in 24 years ago and we didn't have a water softener. Pretty soon we had to buy a new dishwasher. Because the water is so hard. And this is just salt, right? And I think that's what Jesus had in mind when he's talking about you're the salt of the earth that purifies, that brings good into the world. Maybe it's just a way of saying we're supposed to make the world a better place by our presence. So I'm going to close in kind of a different way today. I'm going to ask our worship team to come back. So come back, worship team, wherever you guys are. And we're going to sing. And as we sing, I want you to do something a little bit different. I kind of like symbols sometimes, something, reminders. And so in these two pots, you probably wondered what the pots are here. I have salt. And it's just a little piece of salt in each one. And while we sing, if you with me want to recommit your life in this moment to being what God says you are, that you're the salt of the earth, and that He calls you to be an influence for Christ, then just while we sing, I just want you to walk up and reach in and take a little piece. You can put it in your pocket. It's just a piece of salt. It won't hurt you. And just put it in your pocket. Take it home. And then what I'm going to do with mine is what I invite you to do with yours. What I often do with these kinds of little reminders. I'm going to put it in a place where it will be a silent reminder to me to be salt and light to those around me. Would you do that? Would you just come up and get a piece of salt while we sing, go back and we'll finish up the song, and then I'll give you the blessing. Okay? Let's stand. Come and get a piece of salt while we sing.